Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. More than 870,000 people who fled abroad since the Russian invasion on the 24th of February have now returned to Ukraine, UN humanitarians said in their latest emergency update, amid concerns about deteriorating food security inside the country. Citing the Ukrainian Border Guard, UN Aid Coordination Office OCHA said that 30,000 people are crossing back every day. The recent returnees reportedly include women with children and older persons, compared to mostly men at the beginning of the escalation. Those going back face significant difficulties meeting their everyday needs if returning to their homes is no longer viable, OCHA said. Of the 12 million people in need in Ukraine, humanitarians have reached 2.1 million of them. And the UN's $1.1 billion flash appeal for Ukraine is now 64% funded. Fighting is now concentrated in eastern and southern regions, causing damage and civilian casualties, driving humanitarian needs. OCHA also reported rocket strikes in central and northern Ukraine, and an assessment that almost half of Ukraine now needs demining. Plans reportedly being made by the UK to ask Rwanda to process migrants are at odds with the responsibility that states have when it comes to taking care of people in need of protection, UN humanitarians said on Thursday. In an initial response, UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, said that it understood that the plans were part of a migration and economic development partnership with Rwanda and that it was not party to negotiations that have taken place between London and Kigali. In the past, UNHCR has spoken out against Australia's migrant offshore processing policy, which involved redirecting them to the island of Nauru, thousands of kilometres away in the Pacific Ocean. The UN agency said in a statement, UNHCR does not support the externalisation of asylum states' obligations. This includes measures taken by states to transfer asylum seekers and refugees to other countries, with insufficient safeguards to protect their rights, or where this leads to the shifting rather than the sharing of responsibilities to protect refugees. The world's best-known coral reefs could be extinct by the end of the century unless we do more to make them resilient to our warming oceans. That's the stark message from UNESCO, which is behind an emergency bid to protect these natural marine wonders, 29 of which are on the agency's protected World Heritage List. Our oceans are getting warmer because of increasing global carbon dioxide emissions. The latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change data also confirmed that states must reduce carbon emissions drastically to meet the targets under the 2015 Paris Agreement. Most coral reefs face many other pressures, from pollution to overfishing and habitat destruction. UNESCO's plan, along with partners, is to reduce these threats and to strengthen the sustainable management of fragile marine reefs by supporting local communities. In all, the agency's plan aims to work with 19 World Heritage listed reefs that are found in developing countries, with financing from the Global Fund for Coral Reefs. The development builds on the success of UNESCO's Resilient Reefs initiative, which launched in 2018. For the past 4 years, researchers have worked on 4 World Heritage Reef pilot sites in Australia, Belize, New Caledonia and Palau. The initiative demonstrated that local pressures can be reduced by empowering local communities and helping them to adapt their income and livelihoods to our changing climate. Global warming means that local reef conservation practices are no longer enough to protect the world's most important reef ecosystems, said Fanny Duvert, head of UNESCO's marine program, but she added that a healthy, resilient reef can regenerate after a bleaching incident and survive. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Conor Lennon from UN News. In the West African country of Senegal, the most common form of human trafficking among children is forced begging. Aline Pedram, a crime prevention and criminal justice officer from the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, is working with authorities in Senegal on procedures to prevent, investigate and prosecute cases of human trafficking. Louise Potterton spoke to the anti-human trafficking expert for UN News. Ms. Pedram began by explaining why children are becoming victims of this crime.
They are from families that are very, very vulnerable, live in poor conditions, and they are unfortunately sent sometimes even by their own families to beg in the street. Sometimes they are under the authority of their own parents begging in the street. Sometimes they are under the authority of third persons. If they are under the authority of a third a third party, it's even a third person, it's even more complicated, because then you even can include other aspects in this exploitation. For example, some are forced to beg, whereas they might be even also under sex exploitation, or they might be even forced to work. So you have there a confluation of forms of exploitation.
What is known about the third party? So are they a specific group of people or an organization which is trafficking children for the purpose of forced begging?
This is, let's say, a very delicate topic to speak of, but we have this the so-called, the Quranic, let's say, the Quranic schools. Some persons that they claim to be Quranic teachers, they exploit these children. So children are taken to the Quranic schools on the basis of, let's say, trust, because their parents, they give the children to the Quranic schools thinking that they will, you know, go to a regular school and that they will study the content, and they will also be fed, because this is also something that is in their mind, you know, so that my children at least has the meals, the regular meals during the day. And then actually they become exploited. It does not mean that all Quranic schools, they have this practice. This is very important to highlight. But it's better to put maybe that persons, let's say, using this, you know, institutions or this idea or this philosophy of the Quranic schools, they use the children and force them to beg.
What is Senegal currently doing to protect its citizens from being trafficked, either internally or beyond its borders?
Yeah. Senegal actually has a very interesting and strong system of protection when it concerns child rights, for example. But still you have several situations of exploitation of children due to vulnerability. That's something that, you know, one of the root causes of trafficking, actually. In addition to the existing protection system, they have also created the CNRTP, which is the Commission, Anti-Trafficking Commission. And actually they are in this fight since 2011, so this is not recent. It's a long fight. And also the law anti-trafficking, which is actually pretty old. The law is from 2005. So they are implementing several actions to counter trafficking persons. For example, they do patrols. We prepared standard operating procedures so they can identify, investigate, refer, and adjudicate the cases with a victim-centered approach. There is one specific, let's say, police unit, which is called Brigade des Mineurs, so it's specific for children, and they also do several patrols. And while they are doing patrols to check if the children are in the streets, for example, and bring them back to their parents, or if they don't have a family in the city to bring them to an adequate institution, they also see the signs of trafficking in persons for forced begging, and they take the measures. For example, they start the investigation against the aggressors. They take the children to the protection system. They refer to the family. They try to find the family if the family is not known or not in their whereabouts, for example. So they do several initiatives concerning that, also concerning sex exploitation. There are patrols which are kind of, it's kind of a regular activity of the police. We know that, I mean, everywhere. But the difference is that when you go to the street with an eye and knowing the indicators of trafficking persons, you see differently. It's a different view. It's a different way of seeing the crime scene, or of seeing persons that might be under a situation of trafficking.
So what is your role? What is the role of UNODC?
Actually, we add, let's say, forces to the government of Senegal. It has to be absolutely something that has to come from the state, the member state in itself. They have to be interested. They have to have the will to counter trafficking persons. But UNODC particularly brings more technical capacity, because we are covering many, many states around the globe, and we see different forms, we experience different things, so we can always bring more capacity, we can always bring best practices. So that's the role of UNODC. And in Senegal particularly, what we are doing specifically training, preparation of standard operating procedures, assessments, and a lot of training, actually, we also do.
So at the moment, you are working on standard operating procedures for the identification of victims and investigation of cases. Does this mean that these procedures are not in place at the moment, or they need to be updated?
Yeah. I think they need to be updated. And as I mentioned before, you have to have the counter-trafficking view. So when you go to the ground, if you know the indicators of trafficking in persons, and if you know adequately, if you know the concepts, if you know the difference, for example, between situations of sexual assault and sexual exploitation, trafficking for the purpose of sexual exploitation, if you know the difference between begging and forced begging, so when you see the elements, if you go to the ground and you know the right elements and the right indicators, then you can absolutely act more effectively. So I think the procedures, they are there and they are being prepared to highlight the differences between, for example, when you do a regular patrol and when you do a patrol with the eyes of a counter-trafficking actor, someone that is trying to understand if there is or if there isn't a trafficking in person situation, because the crime is invisible. At the same time that it is invisible, because it is so much within the society, in our daily activities, in everything that we do, it is hidden. So that's why it is so difficult for the actors that are at the front line to identify, and they have to know the signs. And once you know the signs, you are much better equipped to refer, for example, to the correct institutions. You cannot provide assistance to a victim of trafficking the same way that you provide assistance to any other crime victim. It's a different type of trauma. It is a different type of psychological intervention, different type of healthcare, for example. So there are specificities that you have to be aware of when you are providing assistance. And the same applies to investigation. For example, sources of evidence. There are different sources of evidence that you have to take into account. So that's why the procedures are necessary.
So this is the main focus of your work, to use the expertise from UNODC to really train and mentor these frontline responders.
Yes, so basically prepare, a simple guide that they can use at the front line on a daily basis. So it's a very, let's say, simple and user-friendly document that they can consult, for example, even when they are dealing with a case, and train on this guide, let's say, on these procedures, the standard operating procedures. That was the work that we conducted most recently with Senegal.
This is Matt Wells at UN News. Repeated warnings of the effects of the war in Ukraine on developing countries reached a new pitch on the 13th of April when UN humanitarian agencies said that millions of displaced families across eastern Africa will fall deeper into hunger as food rations dwindle amid a lack of sufficient funds, meaning more than 70% of refugees in need do not receive enough to eat. And that same day, the Secretary-General Antonio Guterres launched a report detailing the disastrous consequences of the Ukraine war for those who rely on grain supplies sourced from the country. Joyce Msuya, the UN's Deputy Emergency Relief Chief, joined us in our UN News studio and told Connor Lennon that she'd noticed back in 2021 that the hunger crisis was growing well before the Russian invasion began.
I sort of got a sense of the crisis when I was living in Nairobi, Kenya. I just moved to New York on February 18th. And I remember vividly after Christmas how the food prices went up. Largely then were driven by drought, climate change impact. I was working for UNEP. And that for me was a clear sign that something was not going well. Fast forward now with the Ukrainian crisis, severe drought, which comes immediately after COVID-19 pandemic. We're seeing massive impact of hunger, internally displaced populations in countries like Kenya, Somalia, and Ethiopia in particular. So the Horn of Africa is on our map as one of the priority areas we need to focus on for a multitude of crises, basically.
So when the war in Ukraine began, did you at that point think this could be really dramatic given the amount of grain that is coming from Ukraine and is used for emergency food aid.
Right now, based on the analysis, I mean, if you look at the World Food Program, they buy most of their grains from Ukraine and Russia. If you add that to the impact of climate change around the Horn of Africa, that is a compounded effect. And all these mini crises are adding up to the countries when they're just recovering from COVID-19 pandemic. So absolutely. And then two is the knock-off effect of the Ukraine war is the disruption of the supply chains, the global supply chains. You know, when I lived in Nairobi, most of the containers would come through Mombasa port to go out, in and out. Now with the war, the traffic logistics challenges have been immense. So absolutely there have been, and not to mention the economic challenges as well.
So within the UN, the part of the UN that you're in, the humanitarian affairs wing of the UN, alarm bells were ringing quite early.
Yes. And just to give you a clear example, the Undersecretary General Martin Griffiths, who is the Emergency Relief Coordinator for the humanitarian community, was supposed to visit Horn of Africa literally a few days before the Ukraine war started. And at the request of the Secretary General, he had to postpone that trip because of the crisis. And why was he going there? Because even then, the drought was a real problem in around the Horn of Africa.
And a problem that's been growing for a long time. Past decade, we've seen the number of refugees from East Africa nearly tripling from 1.82 million in 2012 to around 5 million today. 300,000 new refugees last year alone. You mentioned climate change as one of the factors there, but are there other triggers that explain this huge rise?
I'm from Tanzania, coming from Kilimanjaro. It's not uncommon for the Maasai and other ethnic groups to cross over the borders looking for pastoral areas to feed their animals. So that has also been exacerbated by the drought, the internally displaced people. And then as part, in that part of the of Africa, there was also conflict. Ethiopia was one of the countries we were working on. South Sudan, the protracted crisis is another. So there have been a couple of spots where all these new crises are adding on to protracted crises, either caused by climate change, drought, and or internal conflicts.
And given all of these challenges that are coming at once, are the humanitarian agencies of the UN overstretched now?
So we work with a number of humanitarian actors. UN as a system is one part of the story. But for example, we're working with quite a number of NGOs, international, but equally important, the local NGOs, as well as other entities outside OCHA. If you have, currently our estimates show that 15 to 16 million people are at risk of drought, the UN as a system needs the partnership. So it's the entire community, humanitarian community, that is responding to the crisis. I wouldn't say it's stretched, but where we are stretched because of the war in Ukraine is on the financial resources. For example, we are currently planning to have an event at the end of April to mobilize additional resources from donors, from the NGO community and the entire humanitarian community to address the drought and the challenging issues in the Horn of Africa.
And how big is the shortfall in the funding that you need for relief efforts? How much more do you need?
Specifically for the three countries, we are looking at $4.4 billion. That is the gap in terms of the financing. And then we will obviously disaggregate the numbers for each country. For example, if you look at Somalia alone, we're looking at about $1.5 billion financial needs as of now.
And the language that's coming out from some of the agencies of the UN is stark. We're hearing perfect storm of horror, for example. Is that the kind of language that you would use to describe what's happening now?
I would use it horrifying because of the compounded impacts of many crises that are adding up, both globally but also sub-regionally. I mean, let's not forget hardly a year or two ago, these countries were also suffering from the COVID pandemic. Add that to climate change, add internal conflicts, internally displaced populations, and now drought. Think about the malnourished kids who currently are not able to go to school because they're hungry or their learning capabilities are compromised because of malnutrition. So it's a compound effect of mini crises that makes the situation in Horn of Africa absolutely horrifying at the moment.
At the UN, we've been talking a lot over the last few days about the knock-on effects of the war in Ukraine on developing countries, including, of course, the Horn of Africa countries. Do you think the world is finally waking up to the fact that there is this massive interlinkage now between what happens in one country and the knock-on effect it has in other countries?
I would go back to the COVID pandemic as one example, where a viral infection in one part of the world could easily be affect the other part of the world. So yes, I think the Ukraine has been a breadbasket for the world, and so has Russia. So yes, I would say the world is again waking up.
How likely do you think it is that we will see the kind of reform of the international financial system that the Secretary General is calling for in order to mitigate these price shocks that are exacerbating the kind of famine and the hunger that we're seeing in East Africa?
Hard to put a timeline, but I'm quite optimistic with the Secretary General's voice and his good office that progress will be made. I think it's fair to say we have been engaging even in the humanitarian space with international financial institutions through the Interagency Standing Committee. They are quite aware of the scale, the daunting scale of the crisis we are seeing in Horn of Africa, but also globally. So I'm quite optimistic.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russia's military says the flagship of its Black Sea.
This is Laura Quiñones at UN News. Resilience among ordinary Ukrainians is remarkable, but if the war goes on much longer, it threatens 20 years of development gains, the UN Development Program, or UNDP, has warned. From Lviv in western Ukraine, here's Manel Fuani, UNDP lead in the country, describing to UN News' Daniel Johnson the many and varied challenges that the country faces, 7 weeks since the Russian invasion began.
We are here. We're doing our best to address the priorities and needs of war-affected population across the country. And we're talking about people who are in non-government-controlled areas, people who are under direct threat of shelling and military actions. We're talking about people who we managed finally to have access to them in some newly accessible areas. And of course, we keep talking about the IDPs and the displaced people who are coming to the western part of the country seeking safer haven. So this is where we are. We try to adjust, respond, and adapt our response to how we can better serve these people in need.
Right. Thank you so much, Manel. So you're from the UN Development Programme. Maybe you could tell me what you're hearing from the East. What are these people's tales? Because we are hearing the most horrifying stories.
It's actually more than horrifying stories, because we hear stories about people who are facing challenges in having a dignified life, in having a safe and secure life, and in actually ensuring that their families are safe and they are possibly able to avail not only food, but also medicine for them. So as I mentioned earlier, we have different groups of and categories of people. We have people who managed to flee the East and they are seeking safer haven, either they are in transition now or they have actually reached their final destination in the western of the in the western part of the country. We also hear about people not having access to water, people not having access to even safe accommodation in the east. So different situations, different categories, and different levels of threats, I would say. And as the development program in Ukraine, I'm actually happy to report that with our partners on the ground, including in the East, we managed to immediately respond to the priority humanitarian needs. We're talking about a huge partnership with the state emergency services. These colleagues and partners were readily available to immediately respond to helping people under rubble, to ensuring that there are immediate evacuation of civilians from areas of shelling and from areas of high level of threats.
So you do have access to still government-controlled areas. How about the non-government-controlled areas? That must be extremely difficult across the contact line.
Yes, the non-government-controlled areas are definitely in more difficult situation. There are still national partners, Ukrainian partners operating there. They are trying to avail services to the best of their capacity. And what we are doing, as I mentioned earlier, is that we're trying to access people wherever they are, but also we're trying to follow people wherever they move. So those displaced population that have left and fled the east and reached now a relatively safer haven at the west, this is where we're trying to ensure that the local authorities and the local services are availed to them as soon as they arrive and they don't have to wait longer times for them to be served and humanitarian assistance to be delivered to them.
Great. And because the UN Development Programme has been in Ukraine for such a long time, you're well aware of the development gains that we've been told have been lost. 20 years of gains have been lost. What exactly does that mean in terms of roads, bridges, medical and educational, cultural facilities?
20 years of development gains would be lost if this war continues to deepen and to be longer than what we are facing now. So actually, we're observing highest levels of resilience of the government of Ukraine at all levels, national, regional, and local levels. So they are able now to preserve some of the development gains and to ensure that they are sustaining their services, they are availing immediate support and response to the people in need. However, if this war continues, the increasing and mounting challenges on governance, on services, on health, on education, this will not be easily manageable. The poverty will increase, and we're talking about 9 out of 10 Ukrainian people will be under the poverty line. That's a huge number for a country that was doing well just on the 23rd of February 2022. So it is essential that we call for peaceful solution. It is essential that we ensure that peace comes as prominent and as soon as possible so that the Ukrainians can lead the way, if you want, in the reconstruction and rebuilding of their country and their communities.
Thank you. And just to stay with the aims of the UN Development Programme, you want to keep local economies going. You want to keep people able to buy food in the markets wherever that is possible. Maybe you could just explain the day-to-day of some of the partners you're working with, what their challenges are on the ground.
The local partners actually have been really remarkable in the ways they are finding solutions for such humanitarian assistance. They're talking about economic recovery, even we talk about it. They are proposing solutions for relocating certain businesses from dangerous areas to more safer areas. They're looking into production for humanitarian assistance, local production. We're talking in the United Nations Development Program about investing in the humanitarian dollar, as we call it, inside the country. As we all know, Ukraine was the food or the breadbasket for the region. And we are observing a lot of shortages, not only in the region, but also in the Middle East and Africa, and talks about the global impact of the war in Ukraine is pretty much terrifying, actually. So it is essential for us to preserve not only the development gains, but also to preserve the infrastructure for business and economic exchanges in the country, ensuring that the human capital doesn't flee. I mean, we don't want these businesses to leave Ukraine. We want these businesses to remain here in safer areas for now, to be able to return to their original locations when the war is over, and to continue producing to serve the Ukrainian population that is in need of assistance.
Last question to you, Manal. I know you're busy. I can hear people in the crisis hub behind you, but how much longer can Ukraine and its people sustain this level of desperation and horrible stories that we're hearing, and this level of desperate need that they so clearly have in so much of the country?
No one should be able to sustain this for more than, actually, no one should be able to sustain this at all. But it is what it is, what we have. And the Ukrainian have shown us the highest levels of resilience, as I said. And they are able to respond. They are able to find solutions. But we need to continue supporting them. Peace needs to prevail as soon as possible. The Ukrainians need to regain their control over their lives and livelihoods, as they have always done. And it's essential that the government, the parliament, the civil society, the private sector, and all of us in the development sphere and the humanitarian sphere continue availing all types of support to them. The leadership of the people of Ukraine in finding the solution for a better dignified life during this war times is pretty much impressive, and we need to respect that. We need to call for immediate action to stop this war and to help the people return to their homes and to regain their lives and livelihoods as soon as possible.
This is the News in Brief from the United Nations. As the war in Ukraine continues to impact on global food and energy costs, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres issued an appeal on Wednesday to countries to resist hoarding. The UN chief's call comes nearly 7 weeks since the Russian invasion, which has pushed up the cost of food imports for countries in the most vulnerable regions of the world. 1.7 billion people are now highly exposed to disruptions in food, energy and finance systems that are triggering increases in poverty and hunger, the Secretary General said at the launch of the first report by the UN's Global Crisis Response Group on Food, Energy and Finance. Oil prices have risen by more than 60% in the past year, natural gas prices have shot up by 50% in recent months, and the cost of fertilizer has more than doubled, said Mr. Guterres, who also warned that rising inflation has contributed to many developing countries drowning in debt. Solutions to this crisis include lifting all unnecessary import restrictions on food and energy, directing surpluses to countries who need them most, and stopping food price volatility, the UN chief said. On the energy crisis, Mr. Guterres urged countries to release strategic reserves, but also phase out fossil fuels and focus on a just transition to renewable energy. Developing countries must also be helped back from the brink, he insisted, in an appeal to the international financial system to make funds available to them, ahead of meetings of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Attacks on villages in Nigeria's Central Plateau state that reportedly left more than 150 people dead have contributed to widespread displacement in the region, UN humanitarians said on Wednesday. According to the UN Migration Agency, IOM, armed clashes and banditry in north central and northwest zones lasting several days earlier this month have caused new waves of people forced to flee their homes. Field staff have conducted rapid needs assessments and a targeted response is underway, said IOM. These latest attacks coming after outlaws targeted a train late last month, kidnapping passengers. To Egypt, where top rights experts have spoken out against collective expulsions of Eritrean asylum seekers, including children. Several of those deported have not been seen or heard from since their return to Eritrea and are believed to be held in incommunicado detention, the UN-appointed independent experts said. In an appeal to the authorities to immediately halt any further forced returns, the rights experts said that such deportations violate Egypt's obligations under international law. Collective expulsion is prohibited under international human rights law, they said, adding that Eritreans who've been forcibly returned to Asmara faced torture and enforced disappearance, among other abuses, that have been well documented by UN human rights mechanisms. Such expulsions also violate the legal principle of non-refoulement of vulnerable people from one country to another, the experts continued. Since October 2021, at least 68 Eritrean nationals have been deported from Egypt, it's believed. Daniel Johnson, UN News. Hello, 7 weeks since Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the global food and energy crisis that's followed, the UN Secretary General has explained how to get help to the most vulnerable. Climate shocks and chronic violence have also created famine-like conditions and desperate scenes in Somalia and South Sudan, humanitarians tell us, while in Brazil, activists, women journalists and more face appalling violence, a top rights expert has said. In more positive news, we hear how a small town in Italy sparked a global slow food movement. And there's closing comments, as ever, from regular guest Solange Behetege-Cortez. That's all coming up in this week's UN Catch-Up Dateline Geneva with me, Daniel Johnson. First, the news. As the war in Ukraine continues to impact on global food and energy costs, UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres has issued a strong appeal to help developing countries urgently. The UN chief's call comes 7 weeks since the Russian invasion, which has pushed up the cost of food imports for countries in the most vulnerable regions of the world. 1.7 billion people are now highly exposed to disruptions in food, energy and finance systems that are triggering increases in poverty and hunger, the Secretary-General said. Here he is now speaking at Wednesday's launch of the first report by the UN's Global Crisis Response Group on food, energy and finance in New York.
We need to pull developing countries back from the financial brink. The international financial system has deep pockets. I've been strongly advocating for its reform, but developing countries need help now, and the funds are there.
Oil prices have risen by more than 60% in the past year, natural gas prices have shot up by 50% in recent months, and the cost of fertilizer has more than doubled, said Mr. Guterres, who also warned that rising inflation has contributed to many developing countries drowning in debt. Solutions to this crisis include lifting all unnecessary import restrictions on food and energy, directing surpluses to countries who need them most, and stopping food price volatility, the UN chief said. On the energy crisis, Mr. Guterres urged countries to release strategic reserves, but also phase out fossil fuels and focus on a just transition to renewable energy. The threat of famine is very real in Somalia and South Sudan, and urgent action is needed now to avoid a catastrophe, UN humanitarians have warned. The alert on Tuesday followed the latest food security assessments, which showed that 6 million people in Somalia will face acute food insecurity in the coming months, unless the rains come. That is almost double the number at the start of the year, said Lara Fossey, World Food Programme Deputy Country Director in Somalia. She explained that the country last endured famine in 2011 and only narrowly avoided it in 2016-17 thanks to prompt humanitarian intervention.
There are dozens of camps for the internally displaced people, which have grown exponentially in the last few months. Thousands of households are pouring into them from the areas hardest hit by the drought. They're desperately seeking assistance, and when you visit some of these camps, you can see the lines of the new arrivals coming in, and many of these people are women and children, and frankly, it's impossible to see them and not be shocked by the visible signs of destitution and life-threatening malnutrition.
The situation is equally devastating in South Sudan, where two-thirds of the country will likely face hunger between May and July of this year, according to the Food and Agriculture Organization. That means about 7.7 million people, which is the highest number ever recorded. Famine was declared in two counties of South Sudan in 2017, although prompt international assistance prevented the situation from deteriorating further. Finally to Brazil, where a top rights expert appointed by the Human Rights Council has spoken out against appalling levels of violence faced by activists, women journalists and indigenous communities there. Traditional communities, and in particular those of African descent, face the greatest threats, said Clément Voule, who's the Special Rapporteur on the Right to Peaceful Assembly and Freedom of Association. He was speaking at the end of an official visit to Brazil, where he urged the state to create a safe and enabling environment where people could express their views freely. The special rapporteur highlighted the frequent excessive use of force by law enforcement during protests and said that violence against politically elected leaders, in particular Afro-descendant and trans women, posed a serious threat to political participation and democracy. Ahead of general elections in October, Mr. Voule urged the state to ensure that all polls were non-discriminatory, free of misinformation, fake news and hate speech. He also called on the Brazilian authorities to protect candidates from any threats or attacks online and offline. The headlines there. We just heard about growing global food insecurity, and here's another take on the issue from the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO. It's been exploring how one town in northern Italy sparked a global movement to push for low-carbon, local food systems that are more nutritious, equitable and sustainable.
On a crisp, bright Sunday morning, hazelnut producer Elisa Proglio stands under an orange tent with jars and packets of her products spread out around her, nuts, oils, threads, and sauces. She holds out a palm full of nuts, offering customers a sample.
Sì, questo è leggermente tostato. Noi facciamo una tostatura a bassa temperatura.
The hazelnuts are lightly toasted at a low temperature, she explains, to enhance their natural taste without distorting it. Romeo runs the hazelnut farm that's been in her family for four generations with her father and brother. She's just one of the dozens or so local producers that each weekend bring their cheeses and cured meats, wines and preserves to sell here at the Mercato della Terra, or Slow Food Earth Market, in the northern Italian town of Alba. Each fall, Alba draws thousands of visitors for its truffles, a kind of rare underground mushroom that grows in the area. But the surrounding countryside also offers a rich and diverse bounty of agricultural products, grown with environmentally sustainable methods that have been passed down from one generation to the next. The slow food movement was launched in Bra, the town next over, some 40 years ago, by a group of people concerned about supporting small producers of good, clean, and fair food. Those same values prompted 30 local producers here in Alba to set up the Slow Food Earth Market more than a decade ago.
Tutto il giorno mangiamo tutti insieme.
Among them was wine producer and now Earth Market president Gianni Ramelli. He says during Italy's economic boom in the 70s, many farmers moved into town to work for two big companies here, and the direct link with local food producers was lost.
Despite Alba's agricultural roots and being surrounded by countryside, there was no market where local farmers directly sold their products, only supermarkets and stores.
The Earth Day Market, says Ramelli, gives space for local producers not only to sell their produce, but also to share with customers the story of how they're made. Some, like hazelnut producer Elisa Proglia, who sells about 80% of her products here, offer seasonal walks from the center of town to her orchards nearby. Others, like honey producer Marco Giordano, tells his story through taste.
Partiamo con un millefiore che facciamo in montagna, in alta montagna.
Giordano dips a stick into a gleaming jar of wildflower honey for a customer to taste.
Questo qua lo facciamo.
This is the sweetest honey we make, from wildflowers that grow high in the mountain, where there's only me, a shepherdess, cows, sheep, and goats.
Un millefiore di fiore di montagna.
Giordano says selling honey is not just a business.
Perché vendiamo la nostra vita.
We sell our life. We do not sell our products, but our coexistence with bees.
And he says the Earth Market is a place where he can explain that relationship with his bees and with the environment. This past year was a tough one, an especially long cold spell, followed by a scorching hot summer linked to climate change, reduced nectar production. So some types of honey aren't on his table. He says at the market, he's able to share the challenges and also the joys with his customers.
I dedicate the time it takes for first-time customers to explain what we do and what we experience with bees. That's why it matters to me that people give me the chance to have them taste the honey before they buy a jar.
Devono assaggiare i nostri prodotti.
It is fundamental, the relationship between the producers and the consumers, because the story has to be told.
Says Roberta Biliteri, Vice President of Slow Food Italy. She says by story, she means all that goes into a slow food product. Good labor practices, sustainable agricultural techniques, and basic rights, like the right to safe and nutritious food. For the past 13 years, she and her partner have been growing local varieties of bada beans and green peppers in her home region of Sicily. Biliteri says she loves her way of life and the community of small producers she's come to depend on, but it hasn't been easy.
A long time ago, I decided just to produce in a certain way, paying attention to environment, people, quality rather than quantity. The problem is that we live in a system or in a world in which food is a commodity and not a community. And this way of thinking and acting and consuming and producing is definitely the opposite of what slow food is and practice.
Down the Tanada River from Alba is the intellectual epicenter of the slow food movement, the University of Gastronomical Studies, situated in the village of Polenzo, just on the edge of Bra. The university opened in 2004 to students from around the globe, founded by the same person who was key to launching the slow food movement two decades earlier, the now 72-year-old Carlo Petrini.
Il movimento Slow Food nasce alla fine degli anni 80.
Petrini recounts how the slow food movement was born in the late 1980s to protest against the opening of a fast food franchise in the historic heart of Rome. It quickly grew into the global network it is today, with farmers, fishers, nomads, and educators in 110 countries, and the biannual Terra Madre, Mother Earth, gatherings.
The founders of Slow Food had a two-pronged approach. On the one hand, they created a manifesto that exalted and strengthened the idea of a slower and more thoughtful approach to food. But even more important was preserving the cultural diversity that the individual gastronomies of the world express.
Makiko Taguchi is an agricultural officer at the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, FAO. She says focusing on local production has many benefits.
It requires less transportation and less storage, which means a less environmental impact. And also sometimes the consumers get to know the producers, which creates trust between the consumer and the producer and also helps the consumers really appreciate where the food comes from.
And the social element of food production is important, she says.
Each country, each region, city or town has its own cultural and environmental history, which really deeply affects the food system and I think is key to preserving biodiversity. The slow food model really embraces diversity and offers a local approach to sustainable food systems that I think resonates with many people around the world.
Thanks so much to our friends at the FAO for that delicious taste of Italy. Now to wrap up the show, here's regular guest Solange Bejedege-Cortez with some more food for thought. Hi, Sol.
Hola, Daniel. You know that I grew up in La Paz, Bolivia. Well, the sound of the bell reminds me of a tradition. After the religious wedding, some newlywed couples would visit seven churches to take pictures of themselves in front of the main entrance. But once, while eating at a very well-known international fast food diner, I saw a newlywed couple taking a picture in front of it. The image of the bride with her long white dress posing with Ronald McDonald was so strong, something related to status, culture, symbolism, globalization. For the record, long after this episode, McDonald's pulled out of Bolivia. It is now the only country in Latin America where there is no McDonald's, and one of the reasons is that the street food is good and cheap. The interview we heard clearly says that slow food is not just a business, but about telling a story. Not only selling honey, but sharing the story of coexistence with bees. But we have to tell good stories if we want to change the relation between producers and consumers. Stories that will motivate people to take their pictures in small towns, tasting the honey with the producers. Stories that make us to reflect about our relationship with Mother Earth, which is Pachamama in Aymara language. Between slow and fast, local and global, market and supermarket, ethics and profits. As we heard, when we have the choice, we must learn how to eat slow. And to conclude, Daniel, I will borrow the title of a photo exhibition from Alain Fouret, Changez le climat dans votre assiette, which means change the climate in your plate.
Thank you, Sol. I was just looking at Alain Fouret's superb foodie photos from his book that accompanies the exhibition. As the editor's notes say, climate and food are interlinked. 30% of greenhouse gases come from producing the food we eat. all we have time for, so a huge dollop of thanks to everyone out there for hopefully savouring this week's show from UN Geneva, and of course for following the work of the organisation. We'll be back next week. Hope you'll join us too. Until then, bye-bye for now. This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The threat of famine is very real in Somalia and South Sudan, and urgent action is needed now to avoid a catastrophe. UN humanitarians warned on Tuesday. The alert followed the latest food security assessments, which showed that 6 million people in Somalia will face acute food insecurity in the coming months, unless the rains come. That is almost double the number at the start of the year, said Lara Fossey, World Food Programme Deputy Country Director in Somalia. She explained that the country last endured famine in 2011 and only narrowly avoided it in 2016-17 thanks to prompt humanitarian intervention.
There are dozens of camps for the internally displaced people, which have grown exponentially in the last few months. Thousands of households are pouring into them from the areas hardest hit by the drought. They're desperately seeking assistance, and when you visit some of these camps, you can see the lines of the new arrivals coming in, and many of these people are women and children, and frankly, it's impossible to see them and not be shocked by the visible signs of destitution and life-threatening malnutrition.
The situation is equally devastating in South Sudan, where two-thirds of the country will likely face hunger between May and July of this year, according to the Food and Agricultural Organization. This means about 7.7 million people, which is the highest number ever recorded. Famine was declared in two counties of South Sudan in 2017, although prompt international assistance prevented the situation from deteriorating further. In Ukraine, nearly 7 weeks since the Russian invasion, healthcare facilities have continued to come under attack, the UN World Health Organization, WHO, said on Tuesday. According to the agency, there have been 110 attacks on healthcare in Ukraine, including targeting of health facilities and personnel, ambulances, supplies and warehouses. At least 72 people have been killed and 51 people injured, said WHO spokesperson Banu Bhatnagar. Since Russian forces entered Ukraine on the 24th of February, WHO has delivered 216 tons of emergency and medical supplies and equipment to the country via Lviv in the west. More than half of that amount has reached the intended destination, mostly in the east and north of the country where needs are greatest. Here's Mr. Bhatnagar now.
WHO will be providing 15 generators to hospitals across Ukraine that have limited or no power supply. The generators are destined for oblasts in the east, in the south, and in the north. And we have set aside two generators for hospitals in Mariupol for delivery as soon as we can get in.
In addition to pursuing all efforts to reopen operations in Kyiv, the World Health Organization spokesperson explained that the UN agency also wanted to expand its strategic operational base in Dnipro, in the central eastern part of the country, although this still remains uncertain. A top UN-appointed human rights panel issued an appeal on Tuesday for faster progress in finding the remains of people who disappeared during deadly violence that split Cyprus decades ago. The UN Working Group on Enforced or Involuntary Disappearances called for urgent measures to accelerate excavations and the identification and return of the remains of the missing. The panel noted that after the events of 1963-64 and 1974, which led to the island's division into communities of Greek Cypriots in the south and Turkish Cypriots in the north, too many relatives are passing away without knowing the fate and whereabouts of their loved ones. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
I personally believe that light is the best disinfectant, that we have to acknowledge and tell the truth about our history, and then we can begin to repair it. If a family member has wronged you, done something gravely terrible to you that has hurt you, you can't be okay with that family member just because that family member says, you know, I did it to you a long time ago, but that family member never apologized for what they've done, and they never tried to repair what they've done. It is impossible to have reconciliation without acknowledgement and atonement. Once that family member says, I was wrong, and let me try to make it right, then the healing can begin. So what African-descended people are expected to do is to move on without that acknowledgement, without that atonement. And even as we suffer across the globe from being the bottom of every indicator of well-being because of the legacy of slavery, only those who have power are on the side of saying that we have to ignore this history in order to heal. We can't heal by ignoring what happened.
Nicole Hannah-Jones is the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist, writer, and creator of the popular, compelling, and for some people, controversial 1619 Project, a project she did in collaboration with the New York Times. I'm Ben Dutse-Malo. For this latest edition of our Lead Is On podcast from UN News, I had the opportunity to sit down with Nicole here at UN headquarters in New York to talk about her groundbreaking work for racial justice. The 1619 Project is a series of brilliantly crafted essays on race, seeking to throw more light on the legacy of slavery in the United States of America, especially the systemic and endemic racism that has been supported for centuries by laws, by acts, by other so-called legal means. The project also stresses the fact that enslaved Africans have been in the United States of America since the year 1619, and then formed the bedrock of the economic success of the United States long before America's official birthday of July 4th, 1776. Nicole Hannah-Jones has just spoken in the United Nations General Assembly during an event marking the International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery and the Transatlantic Slave Trade here at UN headquarters in New York. Right after she spoke, we invited her into our UN studios, and I began our conversation by asking Nicole to give us the main purpose or the main objective behind the 1619 Project. It's a pleasure to have you here. We know you've just been speaking in the UN General Assembly. I've got your book. I'm still going through it. I think it's a very important book. For anyone who hasn't heard of the book and they are thinking, why is it important for me to get this book or even get it as a gift for somebody, how would you summarize the purpose of it?
Sure. Thank you so much for speaking with me. The 1619 Project is a book that commemorates the 400th anniversary of the first ship that brought the first Africans to the British colony of Virginia. So we mark that really as the beginning of American slavery in the original 13 colonies that would form the United States. And what the project does through a series of essays is tries to center slavery as a foundational American institution and to place the contributions of Black Americans really at the center of the American story. But more than that, to also show the way that the 250-year legacy of slavery in the United States still shapes so much of our society today. And so it's not just about the past, but it's about what has happened right now. And why I think it is important is not just in the United States, but really in the world, we have treated slavery as really marginal to the story of the United States, in many ways to the history of our colonial powers and to the history of the Atlantic world. But slavery is critical. You cannot understand the United States. You cannot understand the Atlantic world. You cannot understand what has happened on the continent of Africa. And you certainly can't understand the great wealth of the Western colonial powers if you don't understand slavery and its legacy.
So when people criticize any talk of slavery and the lingering effects of slavery, and they said, look, slavery ended many years ago. And some of our white brothers and sisters would say, I didn't participate in slavery. Why should you still be telling me about slavery? What would you tell them?
Well, I have lots of answers to that. The first thing I will say is that it is illogical to believe that a system that lasted for 400 years, that reshaped the complexion of the world that enriched the European colonial powers, that laid the foundation for the economic prosperity of the United States, that system somehow does not shape the society that we live in any longer. For instance, in the United States, we've had slavery longer than we have freedom. We have only been a country without slavery for a shorter period than we had slavery. And of course, when slavery ended in all of these countries, we didn't purge the racism that undergirded slavery. So if we look at any of these societies, black people, African-descended people remain at the bottom of all indicators of well-being in all of the former slave societies. So I would argue that clearly the legacy of slavery is still shaping our world. And if people read the 1619 Project, they will see that every single essay is not about something that happened a long time ago. It's about the way what happened a long time ago still shapes and corrupts so much of society today. As for people who say they never engaged in slavery, this is how I see it. None of us were alive, for instance, in the United States when the Declaration of Independence was written. We weren't alive when the Constitution was written. And yet, we understand that that is our legacy. And you cannot only claim the parts of your history that you think makes you look good or that you think are uplifting. You have to claim all of that history. So no, none of us here signed the Constitution, but we believe that Constitution has power, that it shapes our society, and that is also true of slavery. We own all of our history, not just the parts that we find to be positive.
And talking about criticism of your work and the project, I see that people on the right wing of the spectrum have been quite virulent in the pushback. How surprised were you by the pushback against you in political circles and in other circles? How surprising was that to you?
I'm not surprised. I have not been surprised that there would be criticism and pushback of the project. This was a project, and you know, your global audience will know that the United States in particular has been in a great denial about the institution of slavery and its legacy. We are a nation founded on ideals of God-given liberty. We believe we are the freest, most exceptional nation in the world. And slavery and its legacy gives lie to that, right? Slavery is a glaring hypocrisy in a nation that wants to believe that it is the pinnacle of freedom for the world. So to make the arguments that the project argues, that slavery is foundational, that slavery has shaped our economy, our political systems, our culture, was always going to meet resistance in the United States. So that part does not surprise me. But I would be lying if I didn't say the way the project has been weaponized and politicized 3 years after its initial publication has been actually quite astounding. And what that tells you is that history in many ways is about power. It is about who gets to shape our collective understanding, who gets to shape our collective memory, and that power does not want us to understand a history that delegitimizes that power. And that's what the 1619 does. It takes the people who have been treated as marginal. It takes the global crime against humanity that was slavery, and says that that was just as important to the United States and to the Atlantic world as these ideas of liberty. And that is something that's very, very scary for certain powerful people.
I bought the book. I'm reading through it. One thing I realize is the narrative. The normal language says slaves were kept on plantations. You have the house slaves and the field slaves. And the word even slave, I realize in your essays and in the book, you are canceling some words, if I could, use that phrase. Yes. Why is it important to use certain terminologies instead of what is currently there?
Thank you for pointing that out. When I created the project, I actually came up with a glossary of terms to make sure that we would all be using uniform language in describing the institution of slavery, the human beings who were enslaved, as well as you say, plantation, we use terms like slave labor camps and forced labor camps. And the reason that matters, as storytellers, we know that language is powerful. Language can either obscure or it can reveal. And we have used language to obscure the atrocity of slavery. For instance, in the United States, we call these forced labor or slave labor camps plantations, and we have this imagery of this quaint Southern lifestyle of women wearing elegant gowns. But what is behind those beautiful houses is a system of violently enforced forced labor that is undergirded by torture, of human beings being forced to work sometimes to death, of children being sold away from their families, of loved ones being sold away. And so if you think about the concentration camps in Europe, you would never see a wedding at a concentration camp. You would never see a garden party or advertisements about come take a tour of our old way of living. Because we use the proper language. So when we call them plantations and not slave labor camps, it allows us to deny the history of what happened here. When we use a word like slave, slavery was a condition. It was not who these people were. So we don't want to further dehumanize people for whom the systems of slavery tried to dehumanize. A slave owner, we say enslaver. We want to make this an active term. This was someone's occupation. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, we call them planters, but they did not plant. Their occupation was to own human beings and force human beings to plant. So to me, part of in telling the truth about this history is to use the appropriate language, the language that does not obscure but that reveals.
What if somebody says there is this sore or scar on the conscience of America? You are exposing the wound instead of sealing it and healing it. What would you say to that?
Well, clearly, the wound is still festering, whether we want to take the bandage off and figure out why or not. Just 2 years ago, we had the largest protest for black lives in the history of the world because a black man was killed by a white police officer, George Floyd, right, who compressed the oxygen out of this man for 8 minutes. So the wound is there. Those who say that if we talk about this, we make it worse are clearly not the people who are living and suffering under the conditions of this history. I personally believe that light is the best disinfectant, that we have to acknowledge and tell the truth about our history, and then we can begin to repair it. And let me just say in an individual way, if a family member has wronged you, done something gravely terrible to you that has hurt you, you can't be okay with that family member just because that family member says, you know, I did that to you a long time ago, but that family member never apologized for what they've done and they never tried to repair what they've done. It is impossible to have reconciliation without acknowledgement and atonement. Once that family member says, I was wrong and let me try to make it right, then the healing can begin. So what African-descended people are expected to do is to move on without that acknowledgement, without that atonement, and even as we suffer across the globe from being the bottom of every indicator of well-being because of the legacy of slavery. Only those who have power are on the side of saying that we have to ignore this history in order to heal. We can't heal by ignoring what happened.
I am from Ghana. Sadly, it's one place where many slaves or enslaved people were captured from, abducted, kidnapped, and just sold. There is no better way to describe it. I've heard stories in my family, people going to the farm, and on the way back from the farm, they never made it home. What would you like continental Africans who never experienced the horrors of the enslavement of the African in the New World? This morning, it was sub-zero temperatures when I was coming to UN headquarters. And sometimes on the streets of New York, I have this empathetic sense that woman captured from tropical Africa and brought to New York. How did she cope? I'm wearing 5 layers and I'm feeling the pinch. What would you like your Ghanaian brothers and sisters, Nigerians, Senegalese, Africans,
to know about what you have discovered in the 1619 project? Hmm.
That's such a profound and complicated question, because one, we know that our lost, you know, we are the lost brothers and sisters on this side of the Atlantic, but that there also needs to be atonement and repair from the continent. That we know that African peoples, particularly in Western and Central Africa, also engaged in the slave trade. There is certainly a different level of culpability that is entirely distinct from the European colonial powers, but there is a hurt there. There is also a need, I think, for reconciliation for those of us whose ancestors were sold away. We are part of the same families, but we have been torn apart. So I think that acknowledgement of what happened is also necessary on the continent to move towards reconciliation. But then I also hope that those on the continent understand that we are the same people, that even though slavery attempted to erase our Africanness, it was impossible. When I went to Ghana more than a decade ago, I saw people who looked like my grandmother, my great aunts. The dances were familiar. There were dances that I've seen in my own community. Of course, the drum, the music, even the love of gold, big earrings, the bright colors. So we see these connections that haven't been bridged. And I hope that we can also work on that repair as well.
There is a video of one of the kings in Elmina making atonement to a group of diasporan brothers and sisters saying, "We apologize." How much more do we need to see such things? Should Ghana have free visas for the descendants of enslaved people? What more should people on the continent, Senegal, Sierra Leone, Liberia, Ghana, Nigeria, Congo, or Cameroon, where enslaved people were taken away from, what more could we be doing in addition to offering clear, authentic apologies?
One, I think apology goes a long way. I think for so many people, when you've been hurt, you just want an acknowledgement of that hurt. And it's not even necessarily, you know, nothing can be done to change the history. But what we can do is acknowledge what happened and then try to build relationships together. So yes, I think particularly for Black Americans, because we are a small minority in a white country. And there's a children's book that comes with, that I wrote at the same time as the 1619 Project, and it talks about how Black Americans in particular feel like we have no native land to claim. If you come from Haiti, you can claim your Haitian flag. If you come from Jamaica, you can claim your Jamaican flag, because these are Black countries run by Black people, but we don't have that. So for us in particular, I think having a real connection to a nation in Africa would mean so much to us. I know that there are expats from the United States who have communities in Ghana. I know that relationship, particularly because Ghana is English-speaking, because one of our greatest historians, W.E.B. Du Bois, is buried there. I went to his gravesite. That there is a natural connection that I would like to see more formalized. I think Black Americans would love to be able to have citizenship on the continent. When I went, it was transformative. It was, of course, deeply sad to go to Elmina and Cape Coast and see the door of no return. But it also felt so powerful to walk back through that return. And I remember my husband told me it felt like our ancestors were waiting for us to be able to come back. So I think that that reconciliation can be so powerful for all of us.
I just want to move quickly to two key things you said in the UN General Assembly: reparations and also highlighting the resistance. Yes. Why are these two pillars critical in moving forward in a constructive way from the legacy of slavery?
Yes, thank you so much for asking that. I'm so grateful that the United Nations is focusing this year on resistance, because the way that we are commonly taught this history is that somehow Black people, African people, submitted to their enslavement. And by putting forth that narrative, it is used as a justification for slavery. It also, to me, takes away our humanity, because it is not natural to not fight against slavery. And it centers, even in the story of abolition, it centers white people in a way that robs us of our agency. It is not that one day Britain, which was the greatest slave trading nation in the world, one day simply decided, we don't want to do this anymore because it's wrong. It is the mutinies and the revolts of enslaved people that made it untenable for the British Empire to continue importing Africans into its colonies. And then when it decides that it can't do it anymore, it clearly doesn't want other countries to do it because of the competitive advantage. That is how we get to the bans on the international slave trade. The calculation changes because of the constant resistance of enslaved people, and also the resistance when enslaved people were refusing to work, when, as W.E.B. Du Bois said, when they would go on their general strike, when they were destroying tools, it became untenable. So black people who are resisting are pushing the European powers towards abolition, and certainly that happened in the United States as well. So it is just critical for us to have our agency, but also to tell this history truthfully. Of course, we think of the United States as a magnet for oppressed people in other places who come to the United States. What we don't talk about is how black people in this country were denied democracy, were denied rights, the same rights that white Europeans could immediately get when they come to the United States were denied to people of African descent here. And so there was another migration, not just of immigrants coming to the U.S., but of black people in the South. 6 million, the largest migration in the history of the United States, leave the South, often under the cover of darkness because they were forced to labor down there. And the white people who were exploiting their labor did not want them to leave the South. And they decided that they were, too, going to be refugees in their own land and pick up and move to the North searching for a better life and better opportunity. I feel if more people across the globe understood the story of the Great Migration, where, again, 6 million people, black people, leave the South looking for freedom in their own land, they would see themselves, their own immigrant story, in the story of black Americans, as opposed to wanting to say, why are you not doing better in this country of great bounty? Why are you not using your opportunity? That black people have been the ones in the United States who have always resisted, who have fought for democracy, who are the reason why so many black and brown people can migrate to the United States today. So that, to me, was really important. And your last question was about reparations. I don't think we can have conversations about one of the greatest crimes against humanity and not talk about repair. And I noticed that the spokesperson for the Western European countries seemed to rather want to talk about modern-day slavery, which, of course, is a great scourge and that all of us should be fighting. But it seemed like a place like Belgium, with its history of atrocities of colonialism, with its engagement, some of the gravest human rights atrocities that are known to humankind, as well as the Western Europeans who built economies on the backs of enslaved Africans. It is easier to talk about slavery elsewhere than to deal with that original crime. We must have reparations, and I believe in financial reparations across the Atlantic world, and there's a separate conversation about reparations for colonialism as well. But black people in America, for instance, have one-tenth of the wealth of white Americans. A black person with a child has 1/100th of the wealth of white Americans. United States is both.
Despite all the hard work they put in.
Exactly. And it is not because somehow black Americans are lazy, don't want an education, don't want quality housing, don't want to work. We know that that is not true. In fact, I don't understand how the people who were forced to labor for other people can be considered lazy. But financial repair for the legacy of slavery is absolutely necessary. We can look at Haiti, a place that was forced to pay reparations to white enslavers because they liberated themselves. We can look at, in the United States, the only group of people who ever received reparations for slavery were white enslavers in Washington, D.C. The ramifications and the remnants of slavery can be seen in the forced wealth poverty of black people all across the Atlantic world and black nations all across the Atlantic world. And I don't think we can be talking about atonement if we are not talking about repair.
I could talk to you for hours because reparations, I have some thoughts. But we have to draw this to a close. In closing, you are here at the United Nations. Yes. What would you like to see the United Nations doing in support of the noble objectives that your project, the 1619 Project, is bringing to people? What should the UN do?
Well, one, I do have to commend the UN as a body because the UN puts out reports on racism in the United States and is willing to challenge the United States' hypocrisy in ways that you don't often see. I'm here today because the United Nations is acknowledging the atrocity of the transatlantic slave trade. So I think that that is critical. But there certainly has to be more forceful work on the issue of reparations, the issue even of representation in the body of the General Assembly. We can look at many of the nations in the Atlantic world that were former slaveholding nations, and we do not see the African diaspora reflected in who gets to be in spaces like this. So I think there is much to do, but I do also believe that the UN has led in some very important areas. My last word is, it has been a surreal experience to be here and to be able to address the General Assembly of the United Nations. I told the story of my grandmother, who had a fourth grade education, who was born on a cotton plantation, who worked as a janitor until she retired, and she could not have ever imagined that all of her sacrifice would allow me to speak on behalf of our people and our ancestors in this way. So I'm just leaving today feeling very grateful and very honored, and I feel the presence of our ancestors around us.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, as a Ghanaian brother long lost across the Atlantic, there is a phrase I stick to. You are the dream of the ancestors. You were able to return to a place they could only dream of. It's a pleasure to meet you. This is to be continued. More strength, more grace, more power to you. Thank you. That was investigative journalists, and you would say civil rights activist and educator, Pulitzer Prize winning Nicole Hannah-Jones, speaking with me, Ben Dutse-Malo, in our studios here at UN headquarters. Soon after, she gave a moving and memorable speech in the UN General Assembly during an event to mark the International Day of Remembrance of the victims of slavery and the victims of the transatlantic slave trade. This is The Lead Is On from UN News in New York. We thank you for listening.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. A UN-led plan for Ukraine launched on Monday to provide immediate economic help and longer-term assistance to millions of people left struggling to meet basic needs as a result of the Russian invasion. The UN Development Programme, or UNDP, aims to counter the devastation that's been caused by the shelling of cities and early projections that two decades of economic progress could be lost if the war continues. The announcement came as the World Bank issued an alert that Ukraine's economy is set to shrink by 45% this year because of the war. Hit by unprecedented sanctions, Russia's economy has already plunged into a deep recession, with output projected to contract by 11.2% in 2022, the World Bank also noted. Launching the UNDP initiative, its agency chief, Achim Steiner, said that the UN remained committed to helping local economies in Ukraine so that people's jobs were protected. The war continues to inflict immense human suffering, Mr. Steiner said, adding that 9 out of 10 people are at risk of falling into poverty. In Brazil, a top rights expert appointed by the Human Rights Council has spoken out against appalling levels of violence faced by activists, women journalists and indigenous communities there. Traditional communities, and in particular those of African descent, face the greatest threats, said Clément Voule, who's the special rapporteur on the right to peaceful assembly and freedom of association. He was speaking at the end of an official visit to Brazil, where he urged the state to create a safe and enabling environment where people could express their views freely. The special rapporteur highlighted the frequent and excessive use of force by law enforcement during protests, and said that violence against politically elected leaders, in particular Afro-descendant and trans women, posed a serious threat to political participation and democracy. Ahead of general elections in October, Mr. Voule urged the state to ensure that all polls were non-discriminatory, free of misinformation, fake news and hate speech. He also called on the Brazilian authorities to protect candidates from any threats or attacks online and offline. COVID-19 vaccines have been distributed to nearly every country around the world in the last year, but more than 20 still have less than 10% of their populations protected, the UN Health Agency, WHO, said on Monday. At a meeting of the World Health Organization's Strategic Advisory Group of Experts on Immunization, they said that the most vulnerable populations in these 21 countries were still at high risk from the coronavirus. More widely, the WHO panel noted that available data indicated that vaccine protection among high-priority groups was insufficient to provide protection against severe disease and death. Health worker vaccine coverage is 65% globally, but this level falls below 50% in low- and middle-income countries. And vaccine coverage of older adults is 69% globally, but as low as 24% in some regions. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Matt Wells at UN News. As UN agencies warn of an impending famine situation in Somalia, a prolonged drought crisis in the entire Horn of Africa region is threatening to turn into a catastrophe. A combination of the impacts of climate change, conflict and COVID-19 has created the perfect storm of horror, with the war in Ukraine pushing food and fuel prices up, according to UN Children's Fund UNICEF Regional Director for Eastern and Southern Africa, Mohamed M. Fall. He's been in Ethiopia this week assessing the impact of the regional drought on families and children, and started by telling UN News' Joshua Mali what he's seen on his trip not far from the border with Somalia.
I arrived this morning to the fields in the Somali province where I could visit this morning two IDP sites. And what I have been seeing so far is really heartbreaking. It's a population seriously impacted by the severe drought that everyone is talking about, and it has impacted almost all aspects of their life. The IDP I was in touch with have walked 2-3 days before reaching the site, which is close to Gode town, and they have come with almost nothing. They have lost their livelihood, they have lost their livestock, they have the hands are completely empty. And I could see also that UNICEF and partners are working in the field to provide essential services, mainly services related to water and sanitation. Nutrition treatment for children were severely impacted. Health, education. And I have seen also the host community showing hospitality and generosity and sharing the very scarce resources they have with those IDP.
What can be done immediately to help these people in this situation?
I think a lot can be done. Let me first say that one of the reasons of my visit is also to increase a bit the visibility around this crisis. And because, Josh, as you know, we are at a time where most of the focus of the international community and the international media is on Ukraine. And if it's not Ukraine, maybe Afghanistan. But I just want to let the international community know that the crisis that is unfolding here is also one of the biggest humanitarian crises. And I have spoken to IDPs who told me that the drought they are experiencing and facing now is worse than what they have seen even 2016, 17, and 2010, 2011. I think people go back to 4 decades to remember a drought that has this level of severity. Funding is clearly something which is needed, mainly funding for the most immediate need, which are life-saving. As I say, for food and for nutrition, for health, mainly for water and water sanitation, because this drought also is about scarcity and complete lack of water. And I think UNICEF is stepping up its efforts. The partners are stepping up their efforts, but they are far from reaching and matching the level of need that I have seen. We are talking about in the three countries that I mentioned earlier, Kenya, Somalia, and Ethiopia, around 20 million people. And only Ethiopia have close to 9 million people who are impacted severely by this drought.
So you did mention earlier that media attention and global attention is on Ukraine, rightly so. But there might be other ways that this is impacting the situation in the Horn of Africa and where you are in terms of food prices. What would you say about this?
Definitely is there. If you take the three countries that are Ethiopia, Somalia, and Kenya, from maybe 67 or 70% to 90% of their importation of wheat was coming from Russia and Ukraine. And you know also that this crisis had got significant repercussion on the fuel prices, and which impact almost all the prices of commodity, and making it difficult for having goods and commodities available in the market, and when they are available also, making it difficult and non-affordable for the population we are working with. Just one example, we were giving cash to give more possibility of purchasing to the communities, to give cash also, to give to the community their dignity. But this is provided that the goods that they buy is available, but it's provided also that the price are affordable and prices match with the amount of cash that they will have per household. And these are just a few of the challenges. I can't call them the tip of the iceberg, but definitely this Ukraine crisis has become now a global crisis and whose repercussions are felt up to from where I'm speaking.
What does this crisis mean for the children of Ethiopia and the children of the region in general?
A lot, because I think, let's say, they are the most vulnerable segment of the society. Most of this number I'm giving in Ethiopia and in Somalia and Kenya, I can say that half of them are children. And when it comes to children, the repercussions are not only on the life-saving side, like accessing to food, accessing to nutrition, or accessing to water and sanitation. But we have seen also repercussions, like only in Ethiopia, we have over 500,000 children who drop out of school. I have seen also that the form of exploitation and abuse against children are spiking. Just one figure. In one community, they told me that there is a significant increase in child marriage because parents would think that by giving their daughters to wealthier families, maybe they will get dowry that will give them income. But otherwise, also they would have a possibility of maybe giving their daughters to a wealthier family that can feed them. Just one example that has come through the story that I have witnessed and have seen today. Malnutrition needs to be highlighted also because I have seen a spike between 21 to 27% increase from January 2021 compared to January 2022. In terms of severe and acute malnutrition. And as you know, the severe and acute malnutrition is the extreme form of malnutrition among children. It's a major leading cause to death. It has also consequences throughout the life cycle of a human being.
So at the end of the war, he looked for a place to continue rehabilitation work, and the only place available was a garage. And people came to him for help, garage or no garage. There were too many, with bodies often too damaged to be given aid in this place. Everything was crude except the good intentions.
Well, that's old Blue Eyes himself, American singer and actor Frank Sinatra, narrating a tale of high hopes for rehabilitation patients in Indonesia. I'm Matt Wells, and for this edition of our podcast classic series, we'll hear the famous entertainer speak of the debilitating lifelong effects of polio, a disease the World Health Organization, WHO, now has on the ropes with its polio eradication and endgame strategic plan. Polio is one of several vaccine-preventable diseases that WHO hopes to highlight during its World Immunization Week. You'll hear more on that and more from Sinatra later in the podcast. But first, we'll join Sinatra's A Hole in the Head co-star, Romanian-born actor Edward G. Robinson, on a unique hunt.
Her victims were mounting, a reign of terror laying a deadly net over this village in northern Lebanon. She had been seen in several places, but the local police were at a loss to cope with her. My job? Find the murderers.
That was Robinson in 1956, describing the devastation wrought by the malaria-spreading mosquito. In observance of World Malaria Day, we'll revisit this film noir-style dramatization of the fight against the mosquito-borne disease. Afterwards, we'll hear from a malaria expert on the latest developments. Now, here's Edward G. Robinson in The Murderess.
This is Edward G. Robinson. Today, I'm playing a familiar role, but with a not-so-familiar twist. My quarry is a murderer's. I can hear her voice. Her song is sweetly persuasive, soft to the ear. She steals quietly about in the silence of the night, or comes in unexpectedly in the heat of the high noon. She gives no warning of her approach. She tends to seek out warm, inviting places where the food is good and the lodging is comfortable. But do not be fooled by her lilting song, for those can die. That is why I was called in on the case. Her victims were mounting, a reign of terror laying a deadly net over this village in northern Lebanon. She had been seen in several places, but the local police were at a loss to cope with her. My job? Find the murderers. It was about 10 in the morning when my assistants and I climbed out of our jeep into the sun-baked main street of this small village. We brought our equipment with us. If and when we found this she-demon, she wouldn't live long. We would see to that. The chief contacted us presently and told us we might use his house as headquarters. It's a mud house like the others, whitewashed inside. We asked the chief to round up as many villagers as possible for questioning, and soon they make their appearance. An old man approached me cautiously, reaches out a thin hand as if to touch me. He has never seen me before, but he will see me again, often. A woman tries to quiet her crying child. He looks ill, but his lusty lungs fill the room. Now the room is ringed with men and women seated on mattresses on the floor. It's time to begin the questioning. I ask for a description of the wanted female. There are many answers. She's been seen at the village well, in the huts of the people. She seems to be everywhere at once. They all know her, hate her for what she has done to them. Their eyes look up at me dark with fear. I try to calm them with the knowledge that soon she will be apprehended. But their eyes doubt my words. And then her voice is heard in the room. The murderess has returned to the scene of her crime. And it's time for us to go to work. In northern Lebanon, and in many other countries, the word mosquito, the female Anopheles mosquito, to be precise, is synonymous with murder. For her bite can inflict dreaded malaria, the disease that wastes away the population of tropical countries. That is why the WHO the World Health Organization has sent me here with a team of trained experts. We're going to spray this village with DDT, test the adults and children for malaria, and when cases are found, administer anti-malaria tablets. Our object is to rid the village of malaria and its carrier, the murderous mosquito. It's not an easy job. First, we must fight local prejudice against the unknown, the different. We must instill confidence in these peoples that we wish to help them. And we must keep that confidence, for we will be returning again every so often to check on the progress that has been made. We hope it will be a clean sweep. After reports have been written, tests made, the village sprayed, we will move on to the next village and the one after that. Day after day, our little caravan travels slowly after the murderers. I'm happy to say it's becoming more difficult to find her. The lady is slowly vanishing from Lebanon, Greece, the Philippines, India. But it's a time-consuming effort, and this lady, once scorned, is twice as dangerous. We must always be on the alert. You see? Her kind can't easily be eradicated from the earth. She's too persistent, strong-willed. But we will do our best, and in doing so, save millions from the dread of her bite. Just as we tried to stamp out tuberculosis in Costa Rica, malnutrition in Pakistan, hunger and want the world over, we shall keep on pursuing this murderess until her voice is no longer heard on this earth.
The Murderess, narrated by Edward G. Robinson in 1956. WHO has had its attention on malaria since the organization's founding in 1948. This year's World Malaria Day theme is Ready to Beat Malaria. Dr. David Schellenberg, scientific advisor to the WHO Global Malaria Program, spoke to Omar Muzni about how far we've come in the battle against malaria over the past 70 years.
7 decades ago, we knew what caused malaria, we knew how malaria was transmitted, but we didn't really have any tools to control malaria. We were dependent on trying to modify the environment. The malaria control landscape has been completely transformed by the development of insecticides to kill mosquitoes, the development of drugs to treat malaria episodes in people, and also greatly enhanced by the development of diagnostic tests, rapid diagnostic tests, and also more recently still, innovations in information technology, which mean that we can do a much better job of surveillance.
At the same time, it seems as though some of the data from the recent years suggests that there has been a stall in the fight against malaria. What would you say is the most alarming thing about where we are now as opposed to where we were a few years ago?
Okay, well, I think first of all we should recognize the terrific progress that has been made since the beginning of this millennium. You know, in the year 2000, the estimates were that there were 1 million people dying every year from malaria, about 90% of those being young children in sub-Saharan Africa. There were only a couple of malaria drugs available, but there was a high level of resistance to both chloroquine and to sulfadoxine pyrimethamine, the other widely used drug. There was just one class of insecticide that was recommended for the prevention of malaria through the use of insecticide-treated mosquito nets. And although it was known that mosquito nets improved survival, there was no finance mechanism to facilitate the purchase and supply of these nets. The total global investment in the year 2000 in malaria was around about $100 million, which, to put it in perspective, was about the budget of some of the blockbuster films that were being made at the same time. If you fast forward 15 years, over 1 billion insecticide-treated mosquito nets have been distributed. So getting on for 70% of target group in sub-Saharan Africa are now using insecticide-treated mosquito nets. In the same time period, in the last 15 years or so, 6 countries have managed to eliminate malaria. We estimate that something like 1.2 billion malaria episodes have been averted and 6.2 million malaria deaths have been averted. So really astonishing progress. But as you said, in the last year or two, progress has stalled. In 2016, the latest estimates from WHO showed that there are about 445,000 people still dying of malaria every year, 90% of these being young children in sub-Saharan Africa. And probably the root question is, or the root cause of that is a failure to be able to generate the level of resources that are required. About $2.7 billion has been invested in malaria in the year 2016, and that's about 41% of the $6.5 billion that is estimated that would be needed to really make the most of the control tools that are available.
So you mentioned sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, and is it 80% of malaria cases are found in 15 countries and most of those are in sub-Saharan Africa?
That's right, yes. About 80%, as you say, in 15 countries, 70% in 11 countries. Actually, 25% in just one country, and that's Nigeria.
What factors do you think make those countries particularly vulnerable to malaria outbreaks?
So malaria is a complicated disease because it's transmitted by a vector. That vector is the female Anopheles mosquito. And there are lots of different subspecies, each subspecies having different preferences in terms of what sorts of creature it likes to take its blood meals from, where it likes to rest, where it likes to feed, what time it likes to feed. And so the specific details of the vector which is involved in malaria transmission in different places, I think, is a major factor in determining the level of malaria transmission. But there are also issues around the access to quality services to enable the diagnosis and adequate treatment of malaria, which, as we will readily appreciate, greatly vary from one place to another.
Speaking of the mosquito, you earlier mentioned insecticides, and we know that early in the fight against malaria, there was a lot of success using DDT to eradicate mosquitoes, and then they discovered that there were mosquitoes that were resistant to certain insecticides, and also that DDT itself had some side effects. Can you talk a little bit about the current tools that we have to eradicate the mosquitoes, insecticides that we use now, how they affect people, the environment, and whether or not mosquitoes are resistant to them?
I think, first of all, we should make a distinction between eradication of mosquitoes and eradication of malaria. Malaria is caused by a parasite which is carried by mosquitoes. They get infected with the parasite when they feed on somebody who's already got malaria, and then they're very effective at passing it on to other people. So we don't necessarily set out to completely eliminate mosquitoes, but what we want to do is prevent them from transmitting malaria. So DDT has been a very effective part of the approach to controlling the mosquito vectors. As you rightly say, though, there are environmental concerns, and it has been banned from use in agriculture, but it can still play a useful role. Having said that, we're no longer completely dependent on DDT because there are now four different classes of insecticide which are available to control mosquitoes. But we should not be complacent. There's a real need to try to stay one step ahead in the arms race against the malaria-carrying mosquitoes and the malaria parasite itself.
Maybe we can turn our attention now to the patients and those infected with malaria. What can you tell us about the quality of treatment for malaria patients?
In the early 2000s, we were entirely dependent on single agents, single drugs to treat malaria, for example, chloroquine or sulfadoxine pyrimethamine. But resistance has developed pretty rapidly to these drugs. And there was a strong argument that we should be combining drugs which act in different ways on the parasite so that it makes it more difficult for the parasite to become resistant to those. So we are now in a relatively strong position. There are five so-called ACTs, that's artemisinin-based combination treatments, which are recommended by WHO for the treatment of malaria.
And what about immunization and preventive treatment? Malaria Day falls right in the middle of World Immunization Week, and I understand that there is a plan to roll out a vaccine that can partially help to prevent infection.
Yes, indeed. We are now, after over 30 years of concerted efforts to develop this first-generation malaria vaccine, it's called RTSS. We're now in the stages of planning the pilot implementation with a rigorous evaluation in three countries in Africa. So the pilot program will start in Ghana and Kenya and Malawi, just some of the most highly malarious parts of those countries. And we'll run for about 3 years to generate the evidence needed to inform a policy decision about the wider utility of the vaccine.
Could you stress the importance of people participating in the vaccination program against malaria?
One of the major challenges in delivering malaria control is that it depends on people being able to access health facilities when they're sick. The other challenge is getting mosquito nets and vector control products to people in the communities. So we're very eager to evaluate the extent to which a malaria vaccine delivered through routine immunization services can help to build the coverage of effective malaria control tools in a community. Vaccination programs have been running since the 1970s, have been building in strength and offer an unparalleled platform to deliver preventive health interventions.
The World Health Organization's Dr. David Schellenberg there, speaking of the fight against malaria and the promising future of an anti-malarial vaccine, which, if proven effective, can become another tool against communicable diseases. Which brings us right back to World Immunization Week and polio. This year's theme for the week, Protected Together, Vaccines Work, encourages people at all levels to go further in their efforts to increase immunization coverage. Polio cases have decreased by an astonishing 99% since the creation in 1988 of the Global Polio Eradication Initiative, or GPEI, a comprehensive monitoring and vaccination program to deliver a polio-free world. Listen now as Frank Sinatra describes the struggles that faced young polio victims when the disease was still rampant.
Mrs. Frank Sinatra, suppose you were told that a major operation, though not essential, would change your entire life, open new and wider chances for happiness. Would you consent? Well, this was the decision that faced a young man named Ansar. Ansar lived in Indonesia. He lived, though never in his 19 years had he walked or taken a single step. He was a polio victim at the age of 3 months, and when he learned to creep, he had to continue creeping because his legs were too weak for walking. At the age of 19, he was admitted to the rehabilitation center at Solo, where surgery and vocational training are given. They examined him and decided surgery could help. But Ansar refused, absolutely. He said he'd only come there to learn a trade. All he wanted was to be a shoemaker or a tailor or something like that, so he could work sitting still the rest of his life. He refused the operation. So, one might ask, what was the good of this remarkable rehabilitation center in the case of Ansar? It was here that Dr. Sohaso, an Indonesian surgeon, began operating on and repairing as best he could the victims of the 6 years of bitter fighting in that area. And all the time, he thought of the problems that would face these incapacitated men and women. So at the end of the war, he looked for a place to continue rehabilitation work. And the only place available was a garage. And people came to him for help, garage or no garage. There were too many with bodies often too damaged to be given aid in this place. Everything was crude except the good intentions. So Dr. Sohaso looked around for help. But how could he expect anyone to notice his problems in a remote corner of Indonesia? Nevertheless, it did happen. He went on with his work, and in time, word of what was being done at Solo reached the United Nations. The UN sent the well-known American rehabilitation expert, Dr. Henry Kessler, to Solo to observe and report. And it was Dr. Kessler's conviction that the work being done at Solo was unique in that part of the world and could be a model for the whole area. After that, the story becomes one of a remarkable bit of cooperation among government, the United Nations, and many agencies and organizations. Now, there is an orthopedic hospital teaching program, a surgery and all the modern requirements, laundry, kitchen, hot water, sanitation facilities. Also, a brace shop for making braces and artificial limbs, and a vocational shop. But our young friend Ansar gave no thought to an operation for himself. The fact of the matter was that Ansar was much too frightened. But in the ward, he soon made friends. One young fellow in particular interested him, a boy named Mardi. Ansar felt so sorry for poor Mardi because Mardi's hands had been injured and were useless to him. And Ansar brooded about this so much, he discussed it with the nurses and learned that Mardi could be helped if he would submit to a series of operations. After all, even though Ansar himself had troubles, he did have the use of his hands. Well, it seemed to Ansar a terrible pity that Mardi didn't let them operate. Finally, he had to speak to Mardi, tell him he must let the doctors help. Well, maybe it seems ironic, but Ansar was quite shocked when he learned Mardi felt the same way toward him, pitied him. He, Ansar, felt he should let the doctors operate. And so they argued about their cases, kept trying to argue each other to the operating table, until it became a case of, I will if you will. Well, at that point, Ansel couldn't let his friend Marty go first. He had too much pride for that. So, although Ansel was terrified, he rode into the operating room. And later, when he was on his crutches learning to walk, he had the privilege of giving courage to his friend Marty. Now here they are, both recovering and telling each other all about their operations. And that is how two lives were transformed in a garage in Solo, a tiny spot on the map of Indonesia.
The legendary Frank Sinatra, lending his star power to the World Health Organization when it was a little over a decade old. That brings us to the end of this edition of UN News Podcast Classics. You can find the two programs heard here, as well as a wealth of many other archived audio, video, and photos at the UN Audiovisual Library, which is at www.unmultimedia.org/AV Library. I'm Matt Wells. Thank you for listening.